For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I am your host, Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and this is part two of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
But before we raise the curtain on part two of this murder mystery, Robert goes backstage to meet the actors involved, including Juliet Stevenson and Steve Hodson.
And I'll also find out all about spot effects.
Welcome back to the second half of our Read On special, featuring a dramatisation of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie from the Wireless Theatre Company, in celebration of Talking Books. Before we return to the drama, let's go behind the scenes. Alice Glossop and myself talked to some of the cast, many of whom have worked for Talking Books, and I even got to speak to Hercule Poirot himself. First, though, let's find out a bit more about the Wireless Theatre Company.
Hi, I'm Marielle Raneker-Temple. I'm the producer of the show today and the artistic director of Wireless Theatre. Wireless Theatre, we're an online audio theatre company, so predominantly making plays to download from our website. However, we do also do quite a lot of outside productions, so a lot of live recordings and various other studio productions for other companies as well. I was trained as an actress, and when I was at drama school, I did quite a lot of audio acting, and I loved it. And so when I left, I was like, oh, I'll be an audio actor. And then I found it very difficult to get work. I don't know whether that's a reflection on my acting skills, but I thought, oh, I'll see if I can kind of create my own and really just sort of learn how to do it as a kind of hobby to start off with. And then I realised that there was actually quite a lot of interest in the plays that we were making that I put up online, and it just grew and grew and grew. Within 2 years, we'd made, I don't know, like 18 plays, and they were downloaded all the time, and we got loads of good feedback, and it just sort of grew from there, really.
Jessica Bowles is the spot effects engineer. You've just explained to me why it's called spot effects and not sound effects. If you could tell me that again, that would be great.
In radio, doing the sound effects with the actors is called a spot effects. So spot effects for radio is when you're on the spot with the actors doing things live with them, but it's recorded. A couple of scenes where it says tea things. Now that means this noise here. That's a cup of tea. It'll be along those lines anyway. We also have somebody mending an alarm clock. So I have the innards of a very old telephone here. So what I'm going to do throughout that scene, in line with the actor who'll be looking at me, and we will work in conjunction with each other to make this sort of mending an alarm clock noise. After years of experience, you know it's sort of a piece of iron work. I've spent most of the last 30 years looking in people's sheds for things that make a noise which they wouldn't otherwise want to keep. It's a lovely job to have.
You've also got some ice cubes here. There's a treasure box that we've got, so we'll have the sounds of presumably someone opening an old creaky box and someone pouring themselves a nice drink.
But all I can say is cheers.
My name is Juliet Stevenson, and I'm playing Caroline in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
And how important do you think the Talking Book Service is? Because you've narrated some books yourself, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, I've done lots and lots of books. It's such an important thing to do, not just for the blind and the visually impaired, but for everybody, I think. You know, I think we, you know, we're told stories as children, either told them or were read to, and but I think that, you know, it stays with us all our lives. I think we always love to be told stories, and I know lots of adults who listen to audiobooks, and I think whether people are listening because they don't have sight or because they like to be talked to or read to, or they're lonely or they want to be distracted or they have a long car journey or whatever it is, you know, doing the washing up, I think people love to have stories told, and talking books are a way of bringing people inside literature. One of the great joys of reading audiobooks is you get to play all the parts. So your babies, your old men, your French or Belgian or Australian, or your, you know, your 99 or your 5 years old. You get total range of all humanity to produce voices for, which is a great joy, great fun. And then, I mean, well, you're narrating. You're not inhabiting. It is different when you're telling a story or reading a story. You're a vessel, really. You're a conduit through which the story that the author wrote is passing to the listener. I think on stage you're really inhabiting one person. That is a different relationship to the material. You're really sort of inside somebody. You're still a conduit, but you're more. There's a strange hybrid between all of you and the character you're playing. Whereas I think when you're reading, it's very much your job not to interfere too much with the writer's words and just to sort of very much be the servant of their style, their tone, the characters they've written, and not to too much get in the way, while at the same time observing their style and their choices. Mm.
Sarah Whitehouse is playing Flora, who is the niece of the deceased in tonight's piece. How's it going so far?
It's going really well. I'm really enjoying it. It's been quite a long day, but it's always a really good fun day. We have read through the play initially, so we've all got it out loud. Then we've just done a technical rehearsal, so we put put pieces of paper on the floor with microphone one, microphone two, and then we stand by said piece of paper and work out who's going to stand where, what happens if we all bump into each other, that sort of thing. And it's always quite fun, you know. That's the time to have the fun, and then the serious work starts now. We're going to have a proper tech with the live microphones, and then the audience come in, so it's all very exciting. I am a fan of Agatha Christie. I like the Poirot stories. I'm obviously familiar with the quite famous ones like Murder on the Orient Express and Murder on the Nile. This one was one I hadn't been aware of, but it's very typical Agatha Christie, so it's really nice to be part of it, really. Flora, she is the niece with a secret. So as the actor, it's quite nice having that little secret knowledge that the audience may pick up on, may not pick up on. And of course, it all comes out at the end, it's all revealed. And the style, just the 1920s style of the piece is always fun to do. It's all very, I don't want to say melodrama, it's not melodrama, but it's always quite heightened, and there's lots of fainting and screeching and lots of teacups, so it's always fun to do that sort of thing. Funnily enough, I've actually read some talking books for the RNIB, both in Peterborough and at their studios in Camden. I did a fantasy trilogy by Alison Croghan, which was great fun. Lots of wizards and lots of, you know, orcs and things like that. That was great fun. And I think the other one that I remember distinctly was a novel set in Birmingham called Chocolate Girls. And that one was quite close to my heart because it was about the Cadbury factory, and I'm from Birmingham myself. So it was really nice to do that about the history of where I'm from. I think they're fantastic. I think if I couldn't read or if I couldn't have stories in my life, I'd feel so sad. And I think what's wonderful about talking books is that you can still use your imagination. It's not spoiling anything for you. It's not done for you, like, say, in film and television. You can still use the words to create your own scenes and your own characters. And hopefully the actors help a little bit, but they don't do all the work for you. They give you a little clue and help you access that.
Hello, I'm Steve Hodson, and I am playing the narrator and the doctor, who is totally innocent. No spoilers. I'd been away from London for years. I'd been up north doing a television programme. And I came back, and I'd only been back about 6 months, and I got a phone call from the man who then ran Talking Books. He was called Ian Turner. He said, "Would you like to do a book?" And I went, "Wow, yes." And so I did one. It's a tester, really. I think it was based up north. I was born in Yorkshire, so the accent was all right. And then I recorded that, and about a week or so later, when it had all been prepped, supposedly, I got a phone call, "Would you like another?" And I said yes, and that was 1975. Even when I went away sort of filming or doing a telly or in theatre, I always had an RNIB book in my bag, either to prep, or I would phone the studios and say, "I've got Wednesday off, I've got a Friday off," and we'd fit. So you're constantly coming in. What's happened here is that I've been asked to do books that I'm not aware of the authors at all, but it's opened me up to them. So I have met new authors and through being here, and that's been fascinating as well. At the moment, I'm doing a book called Gallipoli, which is about the Gallipoli campaign in the First World War, written by a man called Alan Moorhead, a great historian. It's a fascinating book. The week before that, I was doing two young adults books. You know, it really keeps the old brain box going, you know. Because you have to be authorial voice, you get to play the men, the women, the children, you have to be everybody. And be aware exactly of what the author's intending. So it's absolutely fascinating. If you think about it too deeply, it's terrifying. And I've met a lot of blind people. I was once in the BBC club having done a play there. and the voice boomed across the bar saying, "You're Steve Hodson." And it was a blind guy with his guide dog. And he'd just heard my voice talking to someone, and he'd heard loads of books I'd done and things, and he came bounding across the BBC club, and we had a great night. You've got to talk to somebody like him to realise just how much it means. It means that a young historian can keep up with what's going on, politicians. I mean, I've done all these things, you know. Having done this television series, you see it fan mail, but I got fan mail from the blind reader. There's nothing like it in the world. You've opened up a whole new world. And books are my passion. I have the hugest personal library. I've got about 6,000 books, which my daughters are now stealing bit by bit. And be able to give that to somebody, oh, it just broke my heart and filled me full of pride as well. And when I decided that really, about 3 or 4 years ago, that I might start retiring and running down things, the one thing I could not give up for the life in me was RNIB. I love it. I've loved working for them throughout. I've seen so many different bosses and engineers and producers. It's been a magical time.
I am Hercule Poirot. I am being played by an actor called Ben Whitehead.
And Ben, how is it reading a radio play on stage?
How is it? It's interesting because you get to feed off the audience because you get an immediate response. Hopefully you get you could feel responses, and you do invariably end up like technically having to pause obviously for audience responses, but also it kind of feeds you as an actor, as a performer as well.
This performance tonight is in celebration of 80 years of talking books. How important is it, do you think, that audio books have been available to the blind for the past 80 years?
I think it's very important. And to be honest with you, I have to say, it's important for everyone. I think audio books are a great way to access literature. I love them myself. Because of my mind, I always prefer hearing one voice sometimes rather than a cast. I know I'm doing a cast thing now, but that's just me. It's hard for me to comprehend more than one voice at a time. But I love audio books. There are certain ones I remember from childhood, you know, that it influenced me as an actor. When you know, Norman Shelley was a great audiobook where he used to read the Winnie the Pooh books out, and he had great character voices that really influenced me. As for audiobooks for the blind, you know, it's absolutely invaluable.
And how important are they to Poirot?
Well, I have to try and find the accent now, lead from the mustachio. How does Poirot feel about the audiobooks? I would say they're very good for stimulating the little grey cells. Invaluable. Merci, monsieur.
Poirot gets a little more serious now as we return to the second half of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, performed by the Wireless Theatre Company.
On arrival at Fernley, we were informed that Mrs. Russell was below stairs.
Good morning, Mrs. Russell. Have you made many experiments in blackmail?
What?
Don't excite
How dare
yourself.
You?
Do not excite yourself. Do not play the farce of the honest injured party. You know all there is to know about the blackmail. Is that not so?
I've never been so insulted.
It's insulted in such a way before, no? Well, then why, my excellent Madame Russell, were you so anxious to overhear the conversation in Monsieur Ackroyd's study the other evening?
I wasn't.
Who was your last employer?
My last?
Before Monsieur Ackroyd.
Major Ellaby.
Just so. Major Ellaby. Major Ellaby was addicted to drugs. Was he not? It was hushed up. But you knew about it. You see, I have made inquiries. How much did Major Ellaby pay you to keep your mouth shut? It is useless to deny Hercule Poirot knows. It is so, what I've said about Major Ellaby, is it not?
But I never heard a hair of Mr. Ackroyd's head. Honest to God, I didn't. I've been afraid of this coming all the time. And I tell you, I didn't kill him.
I'm inclined to believe you. You have not the nerve, the courage. But I must have the truth.
It's true that I tried to listen that night. A word or two I heard made me curious. And Mr. Ackroyd's wanting not to be disturbed and shutting himself up with a doctor the way he did. I heard the word blackmail, sir, and I, well...
Had you any reason to suppose that before that night, Monsieur Ackroyd was being blackmailed?
No, indeed, sir. It was a great surprise to me. Such a regular gentleman in all his habits.
How much did you overhear?
Not very much. There seemed what I might call a spite against me. When I did creep along to the study, it was no use. The first time, Dr. Shepherd came out and almost caught me, and another time, Miss Raymond passed me in the big hall and went that way, so I knew it was no use. And then I went with a trade. Miss Flora headed me off. I hope you believe me, sir. I've been afraid all along the police would rake up the old business with Major Ellaby and be suspicious of me in consequence.
Eh bien, I am disposed to believe you. I will wish you good morning. I believe that you have told me the truth. If you have not, so much the worse for you.
So you believe Mrs. Russell's story?
It is credible enough on the face of it. She genuinely believes it was Ackroyd himself who was the victim of blackmail.
Oh, merci. If so, she knows nothing at all about the blackmail of Madame Ferrars.
I must say, Poirot, you were quite hard on her.
Yeah?
Well, Mrs. Gannett was saying that during the past year, Mrs. Ferrars has sold out certain securities, and the money for them was paid into her account and not reinvested. I let the matter drop, of course.
More gossip.
C'est combien?
In all, I should say the various sums totaled at least £20,000.
£20,000 in 1 year?
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Ferrars was a very wealthy woman. And the penalty for murder is not a pleasant one. Eh bien, what about our friend, Mrs. Russell, now? With £20,000 in her hand, would she have continued being housekeeper? Je ne pense pas.
But in that case, who?
Restissement. Who?
Well, as far as I can see, only two could have had the chance of doing it. Ralph Peyton and Flora Ackroyd.
My dear Caroline.
Now, James, don't be interrupting me. I know what I'm talking about. Mrs. Russell met her outside the door, didn't she? She didn't hear her uncle saying good night. She could have killed him then and there.
Caroline, don't you believe Flora Ackroyd's evidence?
What, that she said good night to her uncle?
Yes.
I do not always believe what a young lady tells me, James. Not even when she is charming and beautiful.
But hang it all, Mrs. Russell saw her coming out of the door.
No, that is just what she did not see.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Russell saw her outside the door with her hand on the handle. She did not see her come out of the room.
But where else could she have been?
Perhaps on the stairs.
The stairs?
That was my little idea, yes.
But those stairs only lead to Mr. Ackroyd's bedroom.
Precisely.
You think she'd been up to her uncle's bedroom?
Well, why not?
Why should she lie about it?
Ah, that is just the question. It depends on what she was doing there, does it not?
Oh, you mean the money? Huh? Hang it all. You don't suggest that it was Miss Ackroyd who took the £40.
I suggest nothing. But I will remind you of this. Life was not very easy for her. Roger Ackroyd was always most peculiar, not to say mean about money matters. Flora has run up bills all over King's Abbot. Figure to yourself, then what happens? She has taken the money, she descends the little staircase. When she is halfway down, she hears Madame Russell coming to the study.
She must not be found on the stairs.
She has just time to rush down to the study door with her hand on the handle to show she has just come out when Madame Russell appears in the doorway.
Yes, but later she must have realized the vital importance of speaking the truth. Why did... The whole case hinges on it, Poirot.
Afterwards, it was a little difficult for Mademoiselle Flora. She is told simply that there has been a robbery. Naturally, she jumps to the conclusion that the theft of the money has been discovered.
Naturally!
Her one idea is to stick to her story. When she learns that her uncle is dead, she is panic-stricken.
Young women do not faint nowadays.
Ah, bien. There it is.
Well, I'll not believe it. It's just not credible.
We're not saying she did it, James. We're saying she could have done it. But there it is. The others all have alibis. Who's left? Only Ralph and Flora.
Oh, say what you will. I don't believe Ralph Peyton is a murderer. A boy we have known all our lives.
Well, you may be right, and you may not. I've always said that boy had a weak nature.
But not a vicious one. You said yourself, Poirot, that Ralph was innocent.
That is true.
So then it does leave Flora.
The possibility has been in my mind from the first. I was always convinced that Mademoiselle Flora was hiding something from us.
Well, there's one thing I am sure of, James. Flora Ackroyd does not care a penny piece for Ralph Peyton and never has.
Oh, come on now, Caroline.
Well, then, there is only one thing for it. We must tackle the Mademoiselle.
Shepherd, how good to see you both. Oh, you know, I can't help feeling happy in spite of everything. Oh, that's awful, I suppose.
No, no. Quite natural. You never saw your uncle until 2 years ago, did you? You can't be expected to grieve over much.
And that Uncle Roger has left me £20,000. Think of it. 20,000 beautiful pounds.
Does it mean so much to you?
Mean much to me? Why, it's everything. Freedom. Life. No more scheming and scraping and lying.
Lying?
Oh, you know what I mean. Pretending to be thankful for all the nasty cast-off things rich relations give you. Last year's coat and skirts and hats. Oh, still, don't let's talk of horrid things. I'm so happy. I'm free. Free to do what I like. Free not to.
You're free to have a word or two with us?
Why, certainly.
Mm. Monsieur Poirot here has made a certain suggestion to me. He suggests that you weren't in the study at all last Friday night. That you never saw Mr. Ackroyd to say goodnight to him.
I...
Mademoiselle, the other day, I implored you to be frank with me. You took the money, did you not?
Flora?
Oh, Doctor, Monsieur Poirot, it's been a nightmare these last few days. I am a thief, yes. A common, vulgar little thief. You don't know what my life has been since I came here. Wanting things, scheming for them, lying, cheating, running up bills, promising to pay. Oh, I hate myself when I think of it all. That's what brought us together, Ralph and I. We were both weak. Why do you look at me like that? If speaking the truth would have made things better for Ralph, I would have spoken out. I was not doing him any harm by sticking to my lie.
I see. I can understand your desire to protect Ralph.
You still think that she loves the Ralph Payton?
Mm.
But I, Hercule Poirot, tell you that it is not so. You accepted Monsieur Payton to please your uncle and because you saw in the marriage a way of escape from life here.
But love? No, Monsieur Poirot, you are quite right.
Damn it, Poirot. This alters everything. Those alibis now, worthless. Absolutely worthless. What with all the excitement, I had been rather neglecting my patients and resolved to spend the next day seeing to their well-being. Back home, I strolled into the little room at the back of the house, which I call my workroom. I have kept my tools there, and no one is allowed to wreak havoc with a dustpan and brush. Caroline hates my workroom. She put her head around the door just as I was adjusting the interior of an alarm clock, which had been denounced as wholly unreliable.
And there you are, James. How go things with Monsieur Poirot? Mm. Any developments?
Oh, yeah, not very much. I haven't seen him today.
Oh, you are a sly dog. Yeah. Hand in glove with the great detective. Not a hint as to the way things are going?
I assure you that I don't know a thing. Poirot keeps his own counsel.
Oh, you're so self-contained, James. You hate speaking out or parting with any information yourself. And you think everybody else must be like you. Well, if Monsieur Poirot comes in this afternoon, as he said he might do, I shall not dream of asking him who it was arrived at his house early this morning.
Early this morning?
Mm-hmm. Very early. Before the milk came. I just happened to be looking out of the window. It was a man. He came in a closed car and he was all muffled up. I couldn't get a glimpse of his face, but I will tell you my idea and you'll see that I'm right.
And what is your idea?
A home office expert. A special investigator.
A home office expert? Dear Caroline, what on earth for?
Because Roger Ackroyd might easily have been poisoned in his food that night.
It's nonsense. He was stabbed in the neck. You know that as well as I do.
After death, James, to make a false clue.
Oh, my good woman. I examined the body, and I know what I am talking about. That wound wasn't inflicted after death. It was the cause of death. And you need make no mistake about it.
Oh, you have no imagination whatsoever.
Having endowed you with a treble portion, there was none left for me.
Mark my words, James. You'll see that I'm right.
I was amused to see Caroline's manoeuvres when Poirot duly arrived and was shown into my workroom. My sister, without asking a direct question, skirted the subject of the mysterious guest in every way imaginable. By the twinkle in Poirot's eyes, I saw that he realised her object and remained blandly impervious.
It is that you have really the love of the machinery.
Every man has his hobby.
Decidedly. You should have been an inventor by trade, not a doctor.
Would you like some tea, Poirot?
I would be delighted.
Won't your guest come in also?
Oh, you are too kind, but no, my friend reposes himself. Soon you must make his acquaintance.
Quite an old friend of yours, someone told me.
Quite so, mademoiselle. Monsieur le docteur, I have come to invite you to a little get-together at Larch's tomorrow evening. I think it is time to bring our little problem to a conclusion, n'est pas?
Indeed.
I have invited all interested parties. I am sure you would be interested in my conclusions.
I should think we would all be interested.
I should much like to have you present, mademoiselle.
Ah.
At this juncture, it would not be wise. See, you... All these people tonight are suspects amongst them. I shall find the person who killed Mr. Ackroyd.
You really believe that?
Not yet. But I am close. I have arranged to have the following printed in tomorrow's newspaper.
Let me see. The police have, for some days, been seeking for Ralph Peyton, the stepson of Mr. Ackroyd of Fernley Park, whose death occurred under such tragic circumstances last Friday. Mr. Peyton has been found at Liverpool, where he was on the point of embarking for America.
But that, no, that's not true. He's not in Liverpool.
You have the intelligence so quick. The police were very loath to let me send this paragraph to the press, but I assured them, most solemnly, that very interesting results would follow its appearance in print.
It beats me what you expect to get out of that.
You should employ your little grey cells, Monsieur Detective. Monsieur le Docteur, excusez-moi.
The paragraph, inspired by Poirot, duly appeared in our daily paper the next morning. I was in the dark as to its purpose, but its effect was immense, for Ursula Bourne had appeared on the doorstep.
This is very weak and silly of me.
No, no, my child. We can all realise the strain of this last week.
And then to find that you knew. How did you know? Ralph has been arrested, so everything is useless. I need not pretend any longer.
You do well to make a clean breast of things, Ada.
Listen, I do believe that this husband of yours is innocent.
Husband?
Husband?
But the affair marches badly. If I am to save him, I must know all there is to know. Even if it should seem to make the case against him blacker than before.
How well you understand.
So, you will tell me the whole story, will you not?
Well, when my father died, I was sent out to earn my living. I came to Fernley. I enjoy the work. Then I met Ralph Peyton. We fell in love and...
And you married?
Yes, secretly. Ralph had persuaded me somewhat against my will. Better to break the news to Mr. Ackroyd later, at a more favourable moment. Well, Ralph meant to pay off his debts, find a job, and then, when he was in a position to support me, we would break the news.
Easier in theory than in practice.
But Mr. Ackroyd desired that Ralph should marry Flora.
And here it was that the innate weakness of Ralph Peyton showed itself.
Neither Flora nor Ralph made any pretense of love. They were close, but Ralph loved me.
Flora accepted a chance of liberty, money, and an enlarged horizon.
Ralph, of course, was playing a different game.
He was in a very awkward hole financially. He seized at the chance. His debts would be paid. He could start again with a clean sheet. Both he and Flora would break the engagement after a decent interval.
And what did you say to this?
But Ralph kept it from me. It was like a bomb had hit me when I found out. Then came the moment when Mr. Ackroyd decided to announce the engagement. I made Ralph come up from town. We met in the woods. He implored me to keep silent, to wait.
And did you?
No! I sought an interview with Roger Ackroyd that Friday afternoon and revealed the truth to him.
How did he take it?
He was angry. Unforgivable things were said on both sides. I met Ralph that evening in the small summer house. But I was so angry, I threw my ring at him. We parted. And a little over half an hour later came the discovery of Roger Ackroyd's body. Well, since then, I have neither heard or seen Ralph.
Mademoiselle, I must ask you one question for on it everything, Mayan. What time was it when you parted from Ralph Peyton in the summer house?
Do you think I haven't gone over that again and again in my own mind? It was just 9:30 when I went out to meet him. It must have been about 9:57 when I reached the summer house. Ralph was waiting for me. I was with him 10 minutes, no longer, for it was just 9:45 when I got back to the house.
Who left the summer house first?
I did. I was so cruel to him that night. I was so hard and bitter. I wouldn't listen to what he was trying to say. Wouldn't believe that he really cared. I just stood there telling him what I thought of him and saying the coldest, cruelest things that came into my mind, trying my best to hurt him. I thought you might know where he was. You might pass on a message to him.
Me? Why would I know where he was?
Ralph had often spoken of you, Dr. Shepherd, and I knew that he would be likely to consider you as his best friend in King's Abbot.
My dear child, I have not the least idea where Ralph Peyton is at the present moment.
That is true enough.
But the newspaper...
Ah, that's a bagatelle, mademoiselle. Rien de tout. Not for a moment do I believe that Ralph Peyton has been arrested.
Then...
But now, mademoiselle, no questions. Do not torment yourself. Be of good courage and place your faith in Hercule Poirot.
I ought to go back to Fernley.
No. You stay with me for the present. For this evening, I want, mademoiselle, I beg your pardon, madame, to attend my little reunion. It is most necessary that you should be here.
You're listening to the Wireless Theatre Company perform The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, a special adaptation for Talking Books, and we'll have more in a moment.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Marathon Mates, you and a friend from start to end. Pair up with a buddy and split the distance your way with RNIB's new virtual marathon. Whether you're miles apart or side by side, make your pair and run 26.2 miles between you during the month of September. Inspired by the way many people with sight loss run with a guide runner, Marathon Mates is all about running together. Run with a partner, housemate or family member, or virtually pair up with a mate who's on the other side of the country. Perfect for any fitness level, split the marathon distance however you want. Go equals at 13.1 miles each or find a split that works for you both. Sign up free and be there to support each other through every mile. You'll be raising vital funds for RNIB so we can smash through the barriers that stop people with sight loss thriving. Go to www.marathonmates.rnib.org.uk to join us.
And now a return to the Wireless Theatre Company and their live production of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
That evening, the sitting room at the Larches had been got ready.
Several chairs had been brought in from the other room, and on the table were various syrup and glasses, also a plate of biscuits.
They arrive. Good. All is in readiness.
They all entered and seated themselves. Miss Flora Ackroyd, Miss Raymond, Mrs. Russell.
It is most good of you to come. Now, let us begin. But first, I have an announcement to make to you all. This is Mrs. Ralph Peyton.
Ursula?
They married last March.
Oh, Ursula. We had no idea of such a thing. You and Ralph have kept your secret very well. I am very glad about it.
You are very kind, Miss Ackroyd. Oh, you have every right to be exceedingly angry. Ralph behaved very badly, especially to you.
You needn't worry about that. I do think he might have trusted me with the secret, though. I wouldn't have let him down.
Mesdames et messieurs, you are all suspected persons. Every one of you present had the opportunity to kill Monsieur Ackroyd. This marriage has proved to me one thing, that both Ralph and Ursula Peyton had the strongest motives for wishing Monsieur Ackroyd out of the way. And it also made one other point unexpectedly clear. It could not have been Ralph Peyton who was with Monsieur Ackroyd in the study at 9:30. So, who was with Monsieur Ackroyd? I pose my cleverest, my most audacious question. Was anyone with him?
I don't know if you're trying to make me out a liar, Monsieur Poirot. But Mrs. Russell also heard Mr. Ackroyd talking to someone. We may not be sure of the exact words used.
From the beginning of the case, I have been struck by one thing. The nature of those words. It has been amazing to me that no one who has commented on them has seen anything odd about them. The calls on my purse have been so frequent of late that I fear it is impossible for me to accede to your request. Does nothing strike you as odd about that?
I don't think so. He's frequently dictated letters to me using almost exactly those same words.
Now, if he had been dictating a letter...
You mean he was reading a letter aloud? Even so, he must have been reading to someone.
But why? We have no evidence that there was anyone else in the room. No other voice but Monsieur Ackroyd's was heard, remember?
Surely a man wouldn't read letters of that type aloud to himself, not unless he was, well, going balmy.
You have forgotten one thing. The stranger who called at the house the preceding Wednesday. The young man was not himself important, but the firm he represented interested me very much.
The Dictaphone Company. I see it now. A dictaphone. That's what you think.
Monsieur Ackroyd had promised to invest in a dictaphone. I had the curiosity to inquire of the company in question. Their reply is that Monsieur Ackroyd did purchase a dictaphone from their representative. Why he concealed the matter from you, I do not know.
He must have meant to surprise me with it. Yes, it fits in. You're quite right. No one would use quite those words in casual conversation.
It explains, too, why Madame Roussel thought it was you who were in the study. Such scraps as came to her were fragments of dictation, and so her subconscious mind deduced that you were with him. Her conscious mind was occupied with something quite different. The white figure she had caught a glimpse of. Ursula Bourne's white cambric apron. She saw her as she was stealing down to the summer house to rendezvous with Ralph Peyton.
All the same, this discovery of yours leaves the essential position unchanged. Mr. Ackroyd was alive at 9:30 since he was speaking into the dictaphone. Ralph Peyton...
Ralph and I parted just before 9:45. He never went near the house. I'm sure of that. He had no intention of doing so. The last thing on earth he wanted was to face his stepfather.
It isn't that I doubt your story for a moment. I've always been quite sure that Ralph was innocent. But one has to think of a court of law and the questions that would be asked. He's in a most unfortunate position. But if he were to come forward...
And I have!
Oh! Ralph!
When I was sufficiently master of myself to be able to realise what was going on, Ralph Peyton was standing by his wife, her hand in his, and he was smiling across the room at me.
Have I not told you that it is useless to conceal things from Hercule Poirot? That in such a case, he finds out. Dr. Shepherd went to the Three Boars that night, hoping to find Ralph. He did not find him there, but supposing, I said to myself, that he met him in the street on his way home from the scene of the crime. He must now know that things looked very black against him. Perhaps he knew more than the general public did.
Yes, I did.
Well, I suppose I might as well make a clean breast of things now. Ralph had told me about his marriage and the hole he was in. As soon as the murder was discovered, I realised that once the facts were known, suspicion could not fail to attach to Ralph, or, if not to him, to the girl he loved. I put the facts plainly before him. The thought of having possibly to give evidence which might incriminate his wife made him resolve, at all costs, to
do a bunk?
Yes.
Ralph?
To go into hiding.
But where, though?
Dr. Shepherd has been very loyal. He has stood by me through thick and thin. He did what he thought was best. I see now from what Monsieur Poirot has told me that it was not really the best. I should have come forward and faced the music. You see, in the home, we never saw a newspaper. I knew nothing of what was going on.
The home?
A nursing home. A home for the mentally unfit.
But how did you find him?
I invent a nephew with mental trouble. I consult Mademoiselle Shepherd as to suitable homes. She gives me the names of two nearby to which your brother has sent patients. I make inquiries. Yes, at one of them, a patient was brought there by a doctor himself early on Saturday morning. He arrived at my house in the early hours of yesterday morning. Oh,
Caroline's home office expert. And to think I never guessed.
Well, now we can have your story of what happened that night.
Oh, I'm afraid you know it already. There's very little for me to add. I left the summer house about 9:45 and tramped about the lanes, trying to make up my mind as to what to do next, what line to take. I'm bound to admit that I've not the shadow of an alibi, but I give you my solemn word that I never went to the study, that I never saw my stepfather, alive or dead. Whatever the world thinks, I'd like all of you to believe me.
No alibi. That's bad. Mm. I believe you, of course, but it's a bad business.
It makes things very simple. To save Ralph Payton, the real criminal must confess. See now, I did not invite the police to be present. That was for a reason. I did not want to tell them all that I knew, at least not tonight. I, who speak to you, I know the murderer of Monsieur Ackroyd is in this room now. It is to the murderer I speak. Tomorrow the truth goes to the police. You understand? Mm-hmm. Ah, a telegram.
The murderer is amongst us, you say? You know whom?
I know now. Mesdames et messieurs, this reunion of mine is at an end. Remember, the truth goes to the police in the morning. A bonne nuit.
Confused, all the company trooped out. A slight gesture from Poirot enjoined me to stay behind the rest. I obeyed, going over to the fire and thoughtfully stirring the big logs on it with the toe of my boot. When the door shut behind the last of the party, he came over to the fire.
Well, my friend, and what do you think of it all?
Well, I don't know what to think. What was the point? Why not go straight to the police with the truth, instead of giving the guilty person this elaborate warning?
Use your little grey cells. There is always a reason behind my actions.
Well, the first one that occurs to me is that you yourself do not know who the guilty person is. And therefore, your words were intended to force a confession from the unknown murderer.
A clever idea, but not the truth.
Well, then I fail to understand you. Surely you are running the risk of letting the murderer escape.
He cannot escape. There is only one way out, and that way does not lead to freedom.
You really believe that one of the people here tonight committed the murder?
Yes, my friend.
Which one?
I will take you the way that I have traveled myself. To begin with, there were two facts and a little discrepancy in time, which especially attracted my attention. The first fact was the telephone call. What was the motive for the call? That was difficult. What was the result? That the murder was discovered that night. You agree with that?
Yes.
Très bien. What was the advantage of having the crime discovered that night?
Couldn't say.
And now we come to the second fact. The chair pulled out from the wall. It stood in a direct line between the door and the window. Just in front of the window, there stood a table completely hidden by the chair. And immediately I had my first shadowy suspicion of the truth. Supposing that there had been something on that table not intended to be seen, and that should be removed as soon as possible after the crime had been discovered. And so, the telephone message gave me the opportunity for the murderer to be on the spot when the body was discovered.
Incredible.
Madame Roussel, I eliminated at once, since at whatever time the crime was discovered, she was the one person certain to be on the spot. Also, it was she who told me about the pulled-out chair. Now, what was that object? They all agree with me with my theory of the dictaphone, did they not? But one vital fact seems to have escaped them. Why was no dictaphone found?
I never thought of that.
The attention of everyone was, of course, focused on the murdered man. I think anyone could have gone to the table, unnoticed by the other people in the room, put a dictaphone... Well, but a dictaphone has a certain bulk. It cannot be slipped casually into a pocket. There must have been a receptacle of some kind capable of holding it.
But why remove the dictaphone?
You are like Mademoiselle Raymond. You take it for granted that... What was heard at 9:30 was Monsieur Ackroyd's voice speaking into a dictaphone. But consider this useful invention a little minute. You dictate into it, do you not? And at some later time, a secretary or a typist turns it on, and the voice speaks again.
Ah, you mean...
Yes, I mean that. At 9:30, Monsieur Ackroyd was already dead. It was the dictaphone speaking, not the man.
And the murderer switched it on. And then he must have been in the room at that minute.
Possibly. But we must not exclude the likelihood of some mechanical device having been applied. Something after the nature of a simple alarm clock. Let us recapitulate now that all is clear. A person who knew Monsieur Ackroyd well enough to know that he had purchased a dictaphone. A person who was of a mechanical turn of mind, who had with him a receptacle suitable for hiding the dictaphone, such as a black bag, and who had the study to himself for a few minutes after the crime was discovered, while Madame Roussel was telephoning for the police. In fact, you, Dr. Shepherd.
You're mad.
No. I am not mad.
Dear Poirot, you've been brooding over this case far too long. What on earth had I to gain by murdering Ackroyd?
It was you who blackmailed Madame Ferraz. Who could have had a better knowledge of what killed her husband than the doctor who was attending him? When you spoke to me that first evening, you mentioned a legacy received about a year ago. I have been unable to discover any trace of it. You had to invent some way of accounting for Madame Farrar's £20,000. It has not done you much good. You lost most of it on speculation. So you put the screw on too hard, and Madame Farrar took out a way that you had not expected. Monsieur Ackroyd must have learned the truth and had no mercy. You were ruined forever.
And the telephone call? You have a plausible explanation of that also, I suppose.
I will confess that this was my greatest stumbling block when I found that a call had actually been put through to you from King's Abbot Station. I at first believed that you had simply invented the story, but your good sister confirmed that the call had taken place. I had a very vague notion of how it was worked when I came to see your sister and I inquired as to what patients you had seen on Friday morning. I found what I was looking for. Among your patients that morning was the steward of an American liner. Who more suitable than he to be leaving for Liverpool by train that evening? And afterwards, he would be on the high seas, well out of the way. I noted that the Orion sailed on Saturday, and having obtained the name of the steward, Tom Armitage, I sent him a wireless message now asking a certain question. This is his reply you saw me receive just now.
quite correct. Dr. Shepherd asked me to leave a note at a patient's house. I was to ring him up from the station with the reply. The reply was no answer.
It was a clever idea. The call was genuine. Your sister saw you take it. But there was only one man's word as to what was actually said, your own.
All this is very interesting, but hardly in the sphere of practical politics.
You think not. Remember what I said. The truth goes to the police in the morning. You will hang, Monsieur le Docteur. But for the sake of your good sister, I am willing to give you the chance of another way out. You comprehend me? But Ralph Payton must be cleared. Ça va sans dire. You could even use the dictaphone.
Oh, you seem to be very prolific of suggestions, Poirot. Are you sure you have quite finished?
Now that you remind me of the fact, it is true that there is one thing more. It would be most unwise on your part to attempt to silence me as you silence Monsieur Ackroyd. That kind of business does not succeed against Hercule Poirot. You understand?
My dear Poirot, whatever else I may be, I'm not a fool. Well, I must be off home. Thank you for a most interesting and instructive evening.
Five AM. I'm very tired. But I have finished my task. It's odd how things pan out. I suppose I must have meant to murder him all along. As soon as I heard of Mrs. Ferrer's death, I felt convinced that she would have told him everything before she died. When I looked around the room from the door, I was quite satisfied. Nothing had been left undone. The dictaphone was on the table by the window. Time to go off at 9:30. The mechanism of that little device was rather clever, based on the principles of an alarm clock. And the armchair was pulled out so as to hide it from the door. And then later, when the body was discovered, I did what little had to be done. It was quite little, just to shove the dictaphone into my bag and push back the chair against the wall in its proper place. I wish I'd known beforehand that Flora was going to say she had seen her uncle alive at 9:45. Yeah. That puzzled me more than I can say. In fact, all through the case, there'd been things that puzzled me hopelessly.
My greatest fear all through has been Caroline. I have fancied she might guess. It's curious the way she spoke that day of my strain of weakness. Well, she'll never know the whole truth. There is, as Poirot says, just one way out. I can't trust him. But I so wish Hercule Poirot had never retired from work and come here to grow vegetable marrows.
You have been listening to The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, adapted for the RNIB Talking Books 80th Anniversary by Ross Berman, with Ben Whitehead as Poirot, Steve Hodson as Dr. Shepherd and the narrator, Juliet Stevenson as Caroline, Catherine G as Mrs. Russell, Sarah Berger as Miss Raymond, Sarah Whitehouse as Flora, Zaylee Burrow as Ursula Bourne, and Simon Kane as Ralph. Live sound effects were performed by Jessica Bowles, live music by Gary Carpenter. Pre-recorded sound effects and live recording by Thomas Dinas and Isabel Newbury. Lighting by Gareth Brown. Produced by Marielle Runacre Temple. and directed by Jack Bowman.
That special presentation by the Wireless Theatre Company was in celebration of Talking Books, and it took place in the British Library in London. And the evening was rounded off by a speech from Lord Julian Fellowes, chairman of the RNIB Talking Books Appeal.
It's very easy to feel when you've lost your sight, you've lost everything, and it takes time to take control of your life again. And I think one of the early stages of that for many people can be talking books, to realise that reading at least is something that has not gone. And you are autonomous, you choose your book. And these books that we make are not edited and expurgated, they are the full book. You have the machine that you can operate. You don't need a reader or a helper. You take charge. You are doing it. And I think that is a very important step. But I tell you what I really like, and that is that the first book was not a manual of instruction to help blind people. It wasn't a book of philosophy or history or science. It was a whodunit. A whodunit, a type, a genre that the British have very much made their own. But the point is, you don't read a whodunit for instruction. You read it for pleasure. And they wanted, for that first talking book, for their first blind readers, to have a lot of pleasure. And that tells me that our founding fathers had a set of priorities that was absolutely right. Thank you very much for that.